Well, hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. We're going to talk to Ruth today, and Ruth had a bad trip. I mean, it's a little bit more than that, but essentially, Ruth had a really bad trip one night. And maybe I resonate with Ruth's story because in my early 20s, I tried acid. And I remember that acid trip being, a mess. Friends had to talk me out of running into traffic because I thought I could jump over the cars. I had all these hallucinations and moments that I think profoundly changed me for the rest of my life. I would definitely declare that there was like a Matthew before and a Matthew after that acid trip, and not necessarily in a bad way, but in a different way. That isn't the case for Ruth. One night, she had a bad trip at the hands of a brownie she didn't realize was laced with PCP. And what happened next is the reason she's here to talk to us today. Let's jump into it with Ruth right after a word from our resource partners.
One of our proud resource partners is Eric's House. Here's the deal. Nothing quite prepares us for the heartache of a profound loss. And grief isn't a problem to be fixed, but rather a normal reaction to loss. So when somebody you love dies, it might feel like everything you once knew is true has changed. When we experience that loss, especially the ones that are really unexpected, like suicide or addiction, grief is complicated. That's where the community at Eric's House comes in. Link to them on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word. Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Hello, I'm Ruth Poniarski, and I'm from Long Island, New York.
What story are you here to share today?
I'm here to share with you my story that I have written a memoir, Journey of the Self, which depicts my journey through surviving devastating mental illness and coming of age.
Yeah. So who do you hope hears this?
I hope college students hear it, parents, grandparents, anyone who's going through strife and feels isolated and alone. You're not alone.
So welcome to Learn From People Who Lived It today. We're going to sit down and visit with Ruth, which I'm going to have to tell you out of the gate is one of my favorite names because my mom's father remarried after his first wife passed away, and he married this beautiful woman named Ruth. And so every time I hear the name Ruth, I think of the sweetest soul I ever knew. And so first and foremost, I love that name. Dr. Frank Bavakwa was scheduled to be with us on this podcast today, but guess what happened, Ruth?
What happened?
He and his wife had a baby a couple of days ago.
Wonderful.
And so, yeah, he's in flat out panic mode, I'm sure, right now, trying to figure out what it all means. I don't know if you've got kids yourself, but I do. And I know what a ride it is. And I know how crazy it seems for the first
crazy.
Couple of weeks.
I have two grown kids. One is 34 and the other, and my son is 36. And it was not an easy ride.
Yeah, not at all. Well, listen, let's jump into a little bit about what we're here to talk about today. There's a few things that you guys don't know about Ruth just yet, but you will come to learn. And I would love to start with kind of 0 to 10. I think it's a nice way to get a little snapshot as to kind of how you got wired as a little girl. And so will you give us a sense of the first 10 years of your life, Ruth?
Okay. The first 10 years was pretty smooth. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where men were from World War II and the women, and it was a baby boom. And there were a lot of children in my neighborhood, and we'd play in the snow in the winter. We'd play outside all day, come in and have dinner. I would walk to school. Elementary school was about a mile away. So my brother was older than me, 3 years. We would walk to school. Even when I was 5 years old, we would walk to school. There were no problems, very outdoor life. And then a very interesting event, my mother, when I was at the age of between 6 and 7 years old, my mother, a little eccentric and an artist, she took me to a life drawing class where there was a nude model, a woman by the same name as my mother, Augusta. She said to me, "Don't laugh. I want you to draw the lady." So I depicted it very well. I got the torso correct. And then the bottom part of the body was almost like a Picasso because I sort of lost concentration. At that age, you know, your concentration and discipline, you know, is not that much, but it was enough to depict a Picasso drawing, very advanced.
Let me show everybody what you have here. I went to your website to look at this photo after I knew you would talk about this story. And that is the drawing right there. You can see it on the screen for those of you that are streaming the show on YouTube.
Yeah,
that
six
is
or
what
seven.
You draw.
Yep. So from that moment on, I mean, I was really influenced to look at the physical environment, you know, really like in look at things, you know, just absorb things. And I really, really became an artist from early on, even though I didn't adventure into that in college. I went into architecture because in my youth, I was good in math. Obviously, I was good in art. And in high school, I was good in physics. So I put all those three things together and I said, you know, I'm going to go to architecture school. So that
can I ask you a question really quick?
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm taken by is your mom's decision to take a little girl to a, you know, a class where there's going to be a nude woman to do the thing. And not from the standpoint of like a stuffy standpoint, but from a bravo standpoint, right? Too, because all too often we sexualize situations for kids way too soon. And it would seem to me like this was that. This was your mom saying, hey, you can, don't laugh. You can look at this woman. She's just like you, and you can just draw her, and there is nothing else there. Is that the sense that you've gotten after, you know, because now you can look back on the situation with a different lens, but do you look at it the same way? Like, bravo, mom. Thank you for exposing me there early in the right way.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, my mother was really ahead of her time.
Yeah, sounds like
it. The only thing that really upset me, though, she thought the drawing was so good. She entered me in a contest with 5-6-year-old drawings. They were all, you know, displayed on the wall. And I thought, I believed that my drawing was the best there.
Uh-huh.
It didn't win. Okay.
Aww.
You know, because politically, you're showing a nude in a group of young children's drawings.
Right.
So it kind of like, in a political sense, it didn't belong there. It was like yeah. too advanced. And the mayor of the city was there, and I wouldn't shake his hand. I was so adamant I wouldn't shake his hand. That's
there
how I reacted. I really believed in myself at the age of 6 or 7. I believed that was the best.
Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. I mean, that kind of confidence is the stuff that people would pay for, you know, as an adult. So after, so 0 to 10, you went through that sequence. Would you say that you, for all intents and purposes, had a good childhood, a bad childhood, traumatic, volatile? Like, what kind of word would you use to describe it?
Well, I think it was a good childhood, but the thing in those days was parents didn't really talk about problems in an open way.
Sure.
You know, and that's from my grandparents' generation. They didn't really talk through problems at the table or personally. You know, you'd go to school, you would do your homework. You know, I was bored a lot, and my mother, you know, she gave me French lessons and I went to Hebrew school, but I didn't really connect with what she was offering me.
Interesting.
She took me to the art class. That was the greatest thing, but she didn't continue in that vein with the art, even though art was really, you know, I think that was my essence to like and enjoy art and be good at it. But she didn't really nurture that, even though she started me on that path.
Yeah. Huh. Let's fast forward a little bit. The year is 1977.
Yes.
You are in your fourth year at college, where I guess you're studying to be an architect.
Yes, and it was a five-year architecture program.
So what happens? Give me a little sense of what's shaking out in 1977 that leads you to this big life-altering event for you.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so in 1977, that was the beginning of my fourth year, I returned to college. Let me go back a little bit 2 years hence, 2 years before. In my sophomore year, I was very much in tune with all the architecture students. We were a group, we were a clique. We would have little parties, we would smoke marijuana. Well, and I became a victim of smoking too much marijuana. Mm. And after that, I became paranoid. I became listless, goalless, floundering, not good in my studies. My freshman year was excellent in my studies. My sophomore year, boom, I took a downhill course.
Interesting.
Continued into my junior year. And in my junior year, I had a lovely boyfriend, very, very creative like me. We were like buddies. When I returned to my fourth year, he didn't return. He stayed. He was living in Europe with an American family, and he decided to transfer to Sweden to an architecture school. So we were continents apart. I was really feeling isolated and alone. And also in my junior year, yes, I had dropped out of the core design course. The design course in architecture school. Oh, my dog. Can you hear my dog barking?
He's fine. Yeah. What's his name?
His name is Caesar.
All right. At least we know when he's barking, we know who it is.
Yeah. Anyway, so I dropped the core design course, which was really central to all the relationships with the architecture students in my class. You know, we would congregate and do all-nighters with our projects. You know, we would stay up for 2 or 3 days finishing a semester's project, and we got close. But I had dropped that course in the junior year. I just couldn't do it because of my sophomore year and what I had gone through in my sophomore year. So kind of bled into my junior year, which bled into my senior year. So my junior year, I signed up for a fine arts painting course. So I took one course in that 2 semesters. I really connected with that, but still I had that low self-esteem and paranoia that followed me since my sophomore year. So by the time I got to the 1977, the beginning of my fourth year, I befriended an older gentleman who was a PhD student, and he was a graduate of the architecture school. And he was assisting a professor in the school that I took the course in. So that's kind of how I met him. And he took the place, but not completely, of my boyfriend. He became a friend, and he had a roommate, Hans, who was a PhD physics student, who I had long conversations with. Anyway, so I came back from Thanksgiving in November, and he invited me to this intimate party at his apartment with Hans and a PhD physics student. And they had soda, no wine, no drinking, liquor or anything, just soda and little treats and everything. And the party went through. I was talking the whole party, but I didn't talk to the gentleman that I was friendly with. I talked to Hans and all of his fellow students. At the end of the party, I hadn't eaten anything. I was talking the whole time. I was a very talkative person. At the end of the party, this gentleman who I befriended, I will call him Dennis, he gave me a brownie cake, a delicious brownie cake laced with angel dust, which is a PCP or a tranquilizer for large animals, such as horses or elephants. It's worse than LSD. You know, it's a street drug, but it's worse than LSD.
How so?
I hallucinated. I mean, why did I hallucinate? I wanted to jump out the window. It was a one-story apartment, but I wanted to jump out the window and just run. I wanted to run away. I wanted to run. So Dennis kept me from jumping out the window. Then I managed to sit down on his bed in his room for about an hour and kind of like chill out. And then that wasn't what he planned. He wanted to go further in the relationship. I think that's the big reason. It's almost like the modern Me Too unit. Me Too movement,
yeah,
where they drug you and they want to do more to you.
Yes.
Sort of like that. And I got up after an hour, left the apartment, and I got into my car. And this is college in the north. I won't say the name of the college, but it was in the north. I got in the car. I drove to 90, Interstate 90 that goes to Massachusetts. Got on, went that direction. Then I turned around and I went the other direction through New York. And all of a sudden, paranoia gripped me. I was imagining that there was a revolution going on between the capitalists and the socialists, and my people were leaving in spaceships. They were abandoning me to an apocalyptic world. Oh my God, it just came over me like a surge, like a wave. So anyway, I continued to the New York State Thruway. I got on the New York State Thruway. And I said, oh, maybe I can drive to my boyfriend who had left me for Sweden. His brother was going to a college in Poughkeepsie, New York. And I said, maybe I can go there and confront him and whatever. Then I said, no, I can't. And then I turned around and went back up the New York State Thruway. I went back and forth. And then all of a sudden I went back on it. I parked on the shoulder of the highway. I abandoned my car, I left my pocketbook in the car. I started walking. By the time, this was like midnight now, I kept walking and it was not good weather. It was damp and wet. Somehow I lost my shoes. I walked about 12 miles on the shoulder of the New York State Thruway going.
And you're kind of, you're high, right? You're hallucinating. You're tripping.
Yeah. But in a paranoid way,
paranoid.
And I walked and then till dawn. Now, when the sun came up, reality hit me for a minute. And I said, you know, I hitched a ride back to the college town to where my apartment was. And when I reached the apartment, my father, who was frazzled, was there. Dennis and his nice roommate were there. My two female roommates were there. And I just kind of like zoned out. I didn't pay attention to them. And I'm still going through this period of paranoia and you know, still in a horrid state. But I managed to like bypass them. And my father my father said, you know, we're going to leave. We're going to go. We're going to go home to Long Island.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions about this experience. I when I was like, I think I was about 20, maybe I was 19. Tried acid for the first and only time. And I had a similar experience with it where I got real paranoid for about 2 or 3 hours. And I was like, my friends had to talk me out of running into traffic because I was convinced that I could jump over the cars. And like, it does crazy things to your head. I mean, that's the thing about it. It's such a wild experience. How long beginning to end, but before you felt like yourself again, did that take? Is that a 10-hour process? Is that 15 hours?
No. When I left with my father let me just backtrack for 1 minute, though.
Sure.
The combo of my low self-esteem and my paranoia from the marijuana in the sophomore year lingered. It lingered with me. Again, I never talked about it with my parents. They were never open to my problems to talk about them. So it lingered for two years. And then the combination of that and the PCP, the combination of that like threw me over.
Yeah, right.
It lasted, the effects lasted. Oh yeah, so he took me back. We spent the night in the hotel in the Holiday Inn, and I hadn't eaten for 24 hours either. So I had a little dinner. And the following day, it was the hardest journey for my father to take me back, three and a half hour ride to Long Island. I I wanted to jump out the car. I mean, he had one hand on the steering wheel and one hand on me. I just wanted to jump out of the window.
And like, you were suicidal?
No, not suicidal. Paranoid. There's a difference. I didn't want to end my life. I wanted to run away.
Got it.
The revolution was still going on in my head. I didn't want to be abandoned, even though I was with my father. Wow. So I was irrational, but not suicidal. Never suicidal. With all the stuff I went through, I was never suicidal.
But anyway, paranoid as hell.
That tripping lasted, anyway, the effects, and I couldn't sleep. So, and he took me to a psychiatrist. My first time in a therapy, in a psychiatrist's office, which was a little bit daunting to me because I didn't know what to expect. It was strange. I didn't really want to talk, you know, but he took me there before he took me to our home. And the psychiatrist said to him, you know, your daughter is experiencing a nervous breakdown. He said, she doesn't have to be hospitalized. You have to take her home. I will give you this Thorazine at the time. Thorazine was a very big antipsychotic at the time. Not many medications at that time. I think there was only two. Haldol and Thorazine was the only two available drugs at that period of time in 1977. And so the Thorazine helped me sleep, but I couldn't sleep. I went days with broken sleep. Days. Wow. Days with broken sleep. That's just the beginning of this whole adventure. That's just the icing. That's all it is. But anyway, so after about 2 or 3 weeks, and my mother, you know, my mother was not very overly warm. So she didn't comfort me with a hug saying, Ruthie, it'll be all right. Nothing like that. But she did was she structured my time. We did art projects. We did collages together every day. You know, I had my 3 meals a day. It was a very structured, non-stressful environment.
And creative. That must be mentioned, right? Yeah, you had an outlet for some of these feelings.
Yeah, so it was sort of like occupational therapy, you know.
Yeah.
And so she did that. And she did that instinctively. She didn't talk to anybody about what she should do. She just, you know, followed through with her plan. And that's what we did. So about after two or three weeks, I was back to, quote, normal. And I guess I took the semester off. And then in the winter of 1978, I think it was, The spring, I signed up for the spring 1979 architecture program in Brooklyn at Pratt. I transferred there. I never gave up. I never stopped. I always went forward, never gave up. I had to pursue this degree. I started it. I had to finish it.
Can I ask you a few questions? So, yeah. You know, the podcast is called Learn From People Who Lived It. It's an opportunity, I think, to learn from somebody who's done the dance. And so I've known a lot of people. You must know a lot of people who have all taken drugs. They've taken psychedelics. They've taken acid. They've taken, you know, smoked weed. Like, you know, I know people that have done every drug on planet Earth, and they never had a bad trip. They never had a bad experience. Or if they did, they worked through it. And then as soon as it was done, they were able to set it down. Have you been able to pinpoint what it was about you, and maybe it was the combination that you mentioned earlier, maybe it was the environment, but what do you credit to that bad trip? Was it bad drugs? I mean, what do you think it was?
As I said, I had a very low self-esteem. I was depressed.
Okay.
I was anxiety driven, and I was paranoid. And that lingered from my sophomore year.
And it's almost like that trip turned the volume up on
it. And the fact that my boyfriend, who I decided I wanted to get married to this boyfriend. That's how much I depended on him to come back. And he didn't come back. So I felt abandoned. So the combination of losing him is almost like losing somebody. Sure. He's on a different continent. I lost my love, you know.
Yeah.
And And he didn't realize what was going on. He was too young really to grasp the seriousness of it and what I was going through. And it was devastating.
I can imagine.
And so that combination with the PCP set me off. Plus, yeah. I have a very webbed mind. I'm very creative. And that kind of creative mind, I think, could really be susceptible to this kind of outburst.
I would say 100%, because I have a very similar, like, very creative mind. I don't need drugs to take me to a place. I can go there by myself. And, yeah. You know, this mind can think up just about anything sober. When it's whacked out on something else, boy, can it go to a crazy place. And so I feel yeah. you there. And so the reason that I asked that question, Ruth, is because so many kids, they get in, you know, and it's tough, right? Let's be honest with each other. You and I can both look back because we're removed from it. But man, when you're 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 years old, in so many ways, you're still figuring out who you are and you're still trying to find your way in this world. And if you don't feel good about yourself and, you know, life maybe has you anxiety ridden, like almost the worst thing that you could do would be to self-medicate or to try something like this that could have a very detrimental effect. And what's interesting about your story to me is, you know, all these years later, I can still viscerally feel you when you tell that story. Like, that's how much of an impact it had on your life. And I want other people to understand that that one choice you make, whether you knew that it was this or the other, could have you in a really different state of mind for a long time, one that takes a lot of work and effort for you to battle yourself back from. And so you go back to school, you transfer to Brooklyn. Is it at this stage of the game, are you sleeping better? Are you starting to feel better about yourself? Have you met anybody new? Are the pieces of the puzzle starting to come together still, or does your life feel still anxiety-ridden, paranoid, some of these things?
Okay, I'll let you know. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but for about 7 years, I had breakdowns every 6 months to a year.
Okay, what does a breakdown mean?
Nervous breakdown, just like the one I described to you. Okay. Some were less like ripples, and some were very death defying, like my first one going down the highway. Death defying. I mean, death defying. And I think that the effects of the PCP and the marijuana was in my body. I don't think it went out. You know, it didn't go out. And what I would react to in my life would be social stresses. I was like I had a harsh conscience. Like, did I say the right thing? Mm. People are looking at me. They can see through me. They can see that I had a nervous breakdown. They can see that I'm inadequate. I felt inadequate. And that low self-esteem followed me. Even though I was, you know, I was pretty, I was accomplished, you know. I still, you know, stuck to my guns and I went through architecture. But in between these episodes, okay, I went to school. I traveled, believe it or not. I held jobs, not very well, but I held jobs. I just kept going and I led a double life. I did not let the people around me know, my peers. They didn't know I was breaking down every 6 months to a year. I kept it hidden. I made all the excuses in the book. Nobody
were you embarrassed
really...
by it? Do you think you were embarrassed?
Oh, yeah,
by it?
I was embarrassed. Oh. I had a low self-esteem. And at that time, in 1978 and 79, it wasn't really open as it is today. Even today, it's not even that open.
We think we're so far, but we have so much further to go.
Absolutely. And people look at me when I tell my story. It's like, you know, wow, you know, that's different, you know, or they have a hard time relating to it, or they do relate to it. It's either or.
Yeah.
But at that time, I felt ostracized. Even though I wasn't ostracized, I felt ostracized. It's all going on in my head. Because as I said, in between episodes, I tried to lead a pretty normal existence. And the I will tell you, the psychiatrist I had, okay, he was like in a Freudian kind of bubble where he didn't offer any common sense. He didn't offer any real kind of talking and conversation. Instead, he would have me free associate, talk about what I'm thinking, what I'm dreaming, my past. And I didn't really connect with him. I didn't connect, which is not good, you know. And he also, in time, came remiss to the symptoms of my cyclic demise. And I'll tell you the symptoms that developed. I would lose sleep. Without sleep, you can't do anything. I would lose sleep, and eventually it became severe insomnia in a period of time during a breakdown. I had irrational thinking that everybody was against me. They were going to persecute me. They were ostracizing me. I was a pariah. I was anxious and paranoid, as I said. And I lost my appetite, and I didn't pay attention to the weather conditions outside and that kind of thing. And he never asked me, are you sleeping? Very simple question. Are you
really
sleeping? He never ever asked me. He was remiss. And during my normal time, I appeared pretty normal, you know, even though all this stuff was going on in my head, I didn't really talk about it with him that much. So he kind of, he didn't really read me very well. And for 7 years, and I'll tell you, shall I go to 1984?
Please, yeah, jump wherever you want to go.
It culminated, the whole thing culminated in the worst scenario. Mm. Okay. I signed up for a psychological workshop, like S. You remember Erhard seminar workshop? So a psychological.
I feel like I've heard it before, but I'm not super familiar with it.
That was in the 70s. It was very big. People went, they thought they felt better and psychological. Anyway, this was I call it a psychological workshop. I was led to believe that there were lectures on how to be assertive, how to analyze your dreams and that kind of thing. Instead, it had 30 participants and they had exercises and some of them were confrontational. Well, that made me stressed out. That, again, my whole cycle started again. It was a cycle. Starting out with some sort of social stress or, you know, that would trigger my break. Okay, so I went one day, it was in the city and I was living in the suburbs. I went there and the first day I barely got through. I went there a second day, it was a 5-day workshop. I went there a second day, I barely got through. I came home, I wasn't eating and I wasn't sleeping. And I called them up and I said, I can't continue. Well, they tried to coerce me to come back. They didn't give up. And my partner from the workshop, we all had partners. Believe it or not, he was so abrasive. He came out to my apartment. He knocked on the door and yelled at me to come back to the group. I didn't let him in. I didn't even open the door, but that made me even more paranoid to the brink. So I called my psychiatrist and he said, don't go. Don't return to the workshop. Do not return. I didn't return. He didn't say anything else. He said, maybe increase your medication. I was taking Haldol, I think, at that time.
Okay.
Increase your medication. Well, for me, first of all, I was always in denial, so I wouldn't take the medication. I wasn't disciplined and I didn't take the medication. Not that it helped any. I don't even think it helped me that much at all. Anyway, the third day, my parents were they were on vacation, so they weren't around. They were in a town about 25 minutes away. They were on vacation. And also, by the way, I will add, in therapy, my psychiatrist did not include my parents. He was going on the train of thought that I had to develop independently. I had to be independent and develop outside support systems, which was a major, major league mistake. Be it as it may, so the workshop was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Now we enter Saturday. I'm pacing back, no sleep. And then unfortunately, the neighbors of my apartment in my apartment building, my neighbors were renovating their apartment. So I had these drill sounds going on all day, which were making me even more paranoid. Sunday arrived, my fourth day without sleep or fifth day without sleep.
My goodness.
No sleep. I was pacing back and forth, and then I would sit down and just, I don't know, just sit there. And Monday came around, same thing. I just paced back and forth. I had this art book that I had. I would just look through that a little bit and in a spaced out way. Tuesday morning, I barged into my psychiatrist's office and saying, his office, which is about also 20 minutes away. I said, I don't feel well. He never asked me if I was sleeping. And I just, it was a wall. I couldn't communicate to him that I wasn't well, that this was serious. He said to me, he goes, I have other crisis patients. Please come back at your designated time Thursday night. I left isolated and alone. My parents gave me a call. They were back from their vacation. I said, I can't. I didn't even trust my parents at that point. I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust anybody. I was in this psycho state where I was isolated and I just couldn't get through to anybody. I was yelling, but nobody could hear me. Mm. Wednesday came along, the seventh day without sleep. That was Halloween. I had this idea. Oh, and the drilling was going on in that apartment. You know, it would last till about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night.
Jesus.
And I said, you know what? I want to leave. I want to get out of this my apartment. I want to leave. And I thought if I went through the front door of my apartment, that I would be persecuted and killed. I tied the bed sheets together, flannel bed sheets, to form a rope. I anchored the rope on the steel post of my kitchen table. I brought it to the window, which was about five and a half, 6 feet away. I climbed out of my window, holding onto the sheet. I thought I could rappel the wall. The force of gravity was unbelievable. You never felt a dead iron weight pulling me down. I knew I couldn't rappel. It wouldn't work. So in about 3 seconds, I planned my fall. Feet first and then rolled to my side so I didn't hit my head. I fell 30 feet. This was about 1 o'clock in the morning. I fell about 30 feet, 25 to 30 feet. I landed the way I planned, blacked out, didn't remember a thing. Woke up in the emergency room at the local hospital. I was on the stretcher. I sat up and then I was an idiot. I sat up because I broke my back. And I was still going through my paranoia. I was still in my paranoid state. Anyway, so I had 12 hours surgery, a month in critical care, a month at Rusk Institute Rehab in New York City, 5 months in a wheelchair. And then in January, so that's October, November, November, December. In January, I left Rusk, the beginning. And in January of 1985, I found the right high-risk psychiatrist. I found him. My life changed, not only with the accident, but psychologically my life changed.
Because he found the proper medication for you, because you were able unload?
Not yet. He included he was a Quaker, first of all. He was a Quaker. He was a veteran of World War II. He had 4 children himself. And he said to me, Ruth, no more trips alone to Europe.
Yeah.
No more living on the third floor. We're going to monitor your sleep. We're going to include your parents and even your brother in therapy. He said, and he had sheets, he had essays that he has written on how to maintain your sleep, how to eat properly, vitamin therapy, how to even invest your money, how to have positive relationships. So all of this, and then he was very common sense, and he would add to the conversation, and he would take notes. He would note down my dreams. He would tell me about my dreams. So I learned about myself in a deeper sense.
And this guy sounds like he should have found you, 10 years ago, and it would have been so different, right?
It would have been very, very different, very different.
And here's what I want to just pause you on really quick and to just make sure that we articulate this point to our audience, which is he was super progressive back then, and he embarked on a holistic plan for you. He hit you from all of the angles. He didn't say, you got to figure this out by yourself like that other guy did. He said, no, hold on. We're going to get you rested first, because you can attest to the power of not sleeping. When you don't sleep well for a couple of weeks in a row, or even a few days in a row, it's super difficult to think logically, to even make decisions. Like, that lack of sleep has such a huge impact on us. And I would, so I'll drive a stake into that, which is, like, if you don't feel well and you're not sleeping, you should consider that the sleeping part of it might be the thing that you need to tick off first, because that sleep is so critically important to your health. I mean, you must preach sleep now as somebody who's, a little older and wiser, right?
Absolutely, I do. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I imagine going 7 days without sleep. You know what?
I can't.
It was like I was a soldier. Like, soldiers in war go without sleep. And they have to think and defend themselves and defend their country. Think about the harshness of a soldier's life. I was a soldier in civilian. I was a civilian soldier.
Man.
Wow. In a war myself. And I'm telling you, the end picture of this whole thing was, I'm jumping a little bit. I'm going to jump. Is to accept yourself.
Yes.
And to know, to learn your limitations, because we all have limitations. We all have limitations, and you have to learn that. And that's part of knowing yourself and coming of age, to know what works for you. You know, as far as career, as far as every day taking care of yourself, taking care of others, that you really have to accept yourself and grow to love yourself and understand yourself. And once you do that,
which is harder than it sounds, because
very hard. It took me, it took me many years. I mean, maybe in my 30s, but I started when I was in my 30s, and when I, and hit my new psychiatrist, his name was George. Mm-hmm. And George in 1988, he said, Ruthie, why don't you take up art? Why don't you, take up art? And from that moment, I took up art, and I left the construction architecture world. Let me tell you also what compounded my social stresses and what I went through was being employed in a male-dominated field at the time.
I can imagine.
And I didn't really have a mentor. I mean, my father was there, but he wasn't really a mentor in a specific way in architecture. Even though he was in the construction field, he was a commercial roofer, but he was of the World War II mentality in a way, even though he said, Ruthie, give it up. Don't just give up architecture. It's torture. Don't do it. I didn't listen to him. I went forward. I kept going forward. I had to finish the degree. I had to work. I had to do it. I was in a path with all this going on. I never gave up. I never, ever gave up. I always moved forward. After each break, I would move forward, even though I wasn't moving forward because I wasn't really in the architecture world. I lacked certain disciplines, and I was always given the same rudimentary tasks. So I didn't really advance in the architecture construction world, which also compounded my low self-esteem. Everything compounded.
That's it. It's almost never is it like one thing. It's it's usually a culmination of a few events. There can be one like kind of tipping point, but it is usually a bunch of different stuff. And so let me ask you a question. When you find art, when you make that transition into art, coupled by the fact that you're sleeping, coupled by the fact that you're in therapy and your parents are aware of the situation too, coupled with the fact that you're in a different environment, do you start to shift mentally? Does some of this paranoia and self-esteem start to smooth out for you?
Absolutely. Ever since George, I still had breakdowns and I had major league ones, but they were four years apart. Then they became 6 years apart. Then they became 8 years apart. And knock wood, my last episode was in 2010. Now, after 2010, I started writing my memoir. Now, writing, I have to tell you, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but writing my memoir, I was able to look at myself objectively, minus the emotions, and see the patterns, because there was definitely a pattern of demise, a pattern of my existence. And it happened over and over again. And that's to the sin of my first psychiatrist, who didn't even realize consciously my pattern that was occurring.
What was that pattern?
The pattern was social stress. Then I would start to lose sleep. Then I had irrational thinking, paranoid, anxious. My low self-esteem was blatant. And that would last for a period, no sleep. It would last for a period of 3 or 4 weeks. And then I would resume my life again. I got sleep. But the whole thing is, I think you can narrow it down to lack of sleep. And I'll also say that I think the effects of the PCP and the marijuana over all of the years and all of the episodes started to wear away. It weared away. It was in my head and it wore away. And I will give you this example. George told me, he said he was very keen on news. And he said a journalist back in the 70s or 80s was curious about an LSD experience. He was a journalist. He tried LSD. He ended up in a mental institution in Vermont for many, many years. I don't know if he's ever out. So it can affect certain individuals in a very devastating way.
That's so important to say. And I work with a couple of different organizations where they work with folks and they use psychedelics as a therapy. But even those people are really quick to say, there are certain folks that if they ingest this stuff, it's gonna change the trajectory of their life and they should never ever touch it. And so it's so important for you to say that. Like, honestly, what I said earlier is true. Some people take this shit and they're okay. They learn a couple things from it. They have visions. They figure some things out about themselves. But for other people, it can be an absolute disaster. And it breaks my heart that this happened to you as a young girl, and what happened to you happens to all of us that experience these huge traumatic events. They tend to stick with us for a long time, and they tend to take a long time to sort out because there is no quick, easy fix. How would you describe your state of mind now? You're a mom, you've got two grown kids. I'm assuming you met somebody. How would you describe yourself now?
I'll go back a little to go forward.
Okay.
At the age in 1987. Okay. Yeah. This is like 2.5 years with George. I found the right guy after 13 years of dating and feeling inadequate and not really coming out really positive thinking about anybody really. Although I did have boyfriends. I did. I just never connected because of my secret life. I felt isolated, even though I had friends and boyfriends. I tried so hard for normalcy. So hard. Anyway, I met my husband through a dating service. I had signed up for this dating service, a lot of failures. I said, you know what? This is not working. And then I decided at that point, at the age of 30, I believe, I'm going to be happy with myself and I'm going to live alone. And I threw out all of the guys I had gone to. I threw them all out into the ocean. I said, that's it. No yeah. more. 3 months later, I get a call from the dating service. You know, they say, we have a gentleman that's interested in dating you. So he called me, and everybody knows my name, Poniarski. His name is Richard Poniarski. I said, what kind of name is Poniarski? You know?
Yeah.
What kind of name, you know? But anyway, we went on a date. He came up to my apartment to greet me. He called me Rita. I said, no, my name's not Rita. My name is Ruth. Anyway, we went out on a date, very polite, very sincere. He had gone to medical school in Italy. He was there for 8 years, loved Italy, loved it. But he came back. He moved in to Queens with his parents temporarily. Anyway, so being as that, we had a great conversation. He finished med school, and he was aspiring to be a psychiatrist. And so at that time, I'm saying to myself, you know, I've been through so much. I bet I would make a good social worker. So I kind of connected with him, and I thought, you know what? I may want to study to be a social worker. This was in 1987. We went out on a second date, okay? I was going through a mini ripple. I don't know why I was going through this mini ripple of a lack of sleep, but it wasn't devastating. It was I would call it a ripple breakdown. On our second date, I did not say a word. He talked the whole time. We were in this little Indian restaurant for about 3 hours. We closed the restaurant, and he's looking at me. I'm not saying anything. He's doing all the talking. I didn't say a word. He thought, wow, this is really, you know, what's up with this woman? All right, so we go back to my apartment. He gives me on cheek goodbye. I thought I would never see him again. I thought that's it. You know, he thinks I'm weird and whatever. A week later, he calls me. He goes, let's go see a movie and go to dinner. I guess going to a movie, I didn't have to talk. So we went to a movie. And then I guess the fourth date, around the fourth or fifth date, I told him everything about me. I told him what I had gone through. All the years, all the stuff. It didn't faze him. It did not faze him. I don't even think it registered how serious it was in his mind.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, we got along great. Again, he was a sincere, nice guy, you know, not a mean bone in his body. And he didn't look down on me for what I told him or anything. He just, whatever. Another week goes by or 2 weeks. And I said, you know, if we get, you know, really serious, I have to have a commitment. You know, he got down on his knees and asked me to marry him. So we got engaged about 2 months. In 2 months into the relationship, three and a half months into the relationship, we got married civilly in the city in on Long Island.
How were your folks with this?
They were, I guess they were happy, but they weren't like, they were a little worried. They're always in the back of their head. You know, they're always a little worried.
Yeah, right. As any of us would be after three months. Right.
Okay. So, and then 4 months, in 4 months time, let's see, we met February, April, March, May, June, 5 months, right? Is that 5 months? Five months later, we had a Jewish wedding.
All right.
And the funny thing on the wedding, we're going down the aisle. My parents brought me down the aisle. You know how that goes. And yeah. I'm right on the floor before the bima. When you go up the steps in the temple, you got the bima up the steps to the stage. They left me there. And then, so Richard's parents brought him down before me, and he was up on the bima. He said to my father, bring her up, escort her up to the bima. And my father waved to him and said, come down and get Ruth. Come down and get Ruth and bring her up to the bima. This went on back and forth for about a minute. I'm going, this is finally I'm getting married, and this
yeah.
is...
You guys figure this out here. We got a wedding ceremony.
Yeah, everybody was laughing. Finally, Richard came down and got me, and we went up and we got married.
Look at that.
And we've been married now for over 36 years.
That's incredible. That's incredible. How was life as a mother going through those experiences in the late 70s and early 80s? How do you think that your experiences imprinted you as a mom?
Well, I had a lot of wisdom to tell my kids. Even though my son had difficulty, he had difficulty. And my daughter had, she was easier than my son. My son was very creative and very, you know, he didn't sleep well. And I, you know, it was almost like reliving something here.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And, but we held on. I held on, took him to everything I can help him with, you know, and he turned down. He turned down. He's independent. And my daughter's independent, and that's all you can ask for. But along the way, I had a lot of wisdom to talk to them about. So they would listen, but as they got older, they would listen a little bit more, you know, as, you know.
That's how that works. That's how it works.
Yeah. And I went through a couple of major breakdowns with them. So they were aware. They were aware, which is very different than most children.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is a critical piece. That's one thing as parents we could do a better job on, I think, is helping our kids understand what it means to be aware, not just of them, but of their surroundings and things that they're experiencing and thinking and feeling. And because it would have been so nice to go back to that little girl that you were and say, hey, let me help you with that esteem. Like, that's coming from a place that I can help you with that. And we can work through that. And
yeah.
I don't know if we don't offer that help to people as much as we probably should. What about your husband? Has he been very supportive of
not only supportive, but the other way around? I've been very supportive of him.
Yes.
And because he lived through some of my breakdowns, he became a more aware psychiatrist. He lived through it. So with his patients, he's not just book learned and clinically learned, but life learned. And a lot of psychiatrists, unfortunately, have not been through that kind of a thing with a family member, you know.
Yes. Well, so, listen, I'm going to show it on the screen here really quick for everybody. But this is it, A Memoir of an Artist, Journey of the Self. Ruth, it's been such a treat to get to know you a little bit and figure out how you got from point A to point B. And what a wild ride. I mean, from tripping on drugs to driving your car up and down the freeway to jumping out of a building. Look, it all worked out. And I think if there's an underlying message here, it's this message of hope. It's that it can feel crazy right now. It can feel out of control right now. You could not be sleeping. You could not be in good relationships. You could not be in a good job. Your life might feel like a jungle gym, but it is possible that you can heal. It is possible that you will work yourself out of that situation, and it doesn't have to be your forever. Isn't that, I mean, so important to let people know while they're going through hard things?
Absolutely, and they're not alone. These people think that they're all alone, but they're not. Read books. I'm telling you, read biographies, I tell people. And also, I said, keep a journal. Keep a journal of what you're going through, your feelings. You know, keep a journal, reach and also.
If there's one more question I can ask you, it's to kind of take us back to where you started, which was the late 70s and taking the PCP.
Yes.
For somebody that's taken drugs and had a really adverse reaction to them, what kind of advice might you offer? Where would be a good place for them to funnel some of this confusing energy?
Well, if you take it, I would suggest talking to a counselor or somebody.
Okay.
Don't think that you're, you know, there's no hope. You know, if you react that way, talk to somebody, communicate. I mean, it could be a counselor, it could be a family member, it could be a religious person. You have to communicate. You really have to talk it out, you know, not just keep it within, you know, and go nuts, you know, really. And find that person. I also want to say to you, it took about 20 years to find the right medication.
Right.
I found the right medication in 1999, an antipsychotic. And the right dosage was a few more years later to find the right dosage. So I say to people, if the medicine you're taking is not working, because it's a very gray thing with psychotropics, very gray, try another one. Don't hesitate. Don't wait. And if you're not connecting with your therapist, social worker, or person that you're talking to, try somebody else. Don't wait. Don't wait 2 years. Right. I'm saying, you know, because it's a very gray field. It's not like a heart attack where you have a medication. If that one's not working, you have another medication. That's sort of like black and white. Right. But the mental is very gray. It's very hard to define. And if somebody does want to end their life, that's really hard to decipher as somebody else. It's all inside of them. So that's a really hard line to hold, to save, you know.
I do. We've said it so many times on this show. If your first therapist isn't a fit, you got to go to the second one. If the first medication isn't right, you got to keep moving to the second one.
And the beauty of today,
you only lose when you stop moving. Say that again.
And the beauty of today is there are many medications. There are many. Back when mine, there was only one or two medications.
Right.
You know, and also therapy, you can have therapy online. There, you can go online and get therapy. You can sign up for a counselor online. So there is avenues you can take, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I love it. What a fun chat. Thank you for helping us understand a little bit more about it. And I was also thinking, didn't you say that your husband is a psychiatrist?
Yes.
Is this not proof that the world works like you ended up with the psychiatrist? That's amazing.
And I'm his therapist.
Bravo. Ruth, continued success with life and this new book, The Memoir of an Artist, Journey of the Self. And we appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. One, to help you feel less alone. Two, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. Three, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn from People Who Lived It, wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn from People Who Lived It.
You've probably heard me say this before, but most of the things that kill us are preventable. And that's exactly why I put my heart in his hands, in his care. I'm talking about Dr. Robert Todd Hurst and HealthSpan MD. He's my cardiologist because I appreciate his holistic approach to heart health. There's nothing out there like HealthSpan MD, his AFib reversal program, his CAD reversal program. Get the link on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. At Metal Joe, they sell more than shirts. They sell apparel with a purpose. In fact, my favorite hoodie in my closet is a Mental Joe hoodie. They help out G.I. Joes to the average Joe's one t-shirt at a time. With every purchase, you help them support organizations that can provide services to help others get out of their heads and into their bodies through plant medicines, equine therapy, yoga, and other non-traditional mental health treatments. Link to them. Pick out your favorite t-shirt or hoodie right now at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com/resources.